are listening to 2012 Journey to Evolution. I'm Tambourine Borelli, being with you today and looking forward to bringing you yet another example of where the evolution of matter and spirit meet. The aspect of matter representing us as spiritual divine beings having this human experience. And I'm sure most can agree that it takes a lot of courage sometimes to evolve within this human experience, going beyond the confines of fear, transcending into higher versions of ourselves, ultimately choosing to be a part of a higher version of our earth and of our human family. My guest today embodies the essence of this description. John Perkins is the well-known author of the New York Times bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He spent 3 decades living as an economic hitman, a business executive, author, and lecturer. He lived and worked in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, and North America. Then he made a decision. He would use these experiences to make the planet a better place for his daughter's generation. Today, he teaches about the importance of rising to a higher level of consciousness, waking up in both spiritual and physical realms. He's a champion for environmental and social causes. He's lectured at universities on 4 continents, including Harvard, Wharton, and Princeton. His experiences and subsequent evolution from being and living as a part of the problem and then transcending into a part of the solution. He gives groundbreaking insight from every region of the world and offers ideas on how we, everyday people, can change the world right where we are. John, I'm so honored to have you. Welcome to the show.
Gee, thank you so much, Tambourine. That was a great introduction. I don't know how to follow up on it, but we'll try.
Well, my dear, you are definitely worthy of every word. I'm very, very genuinely honored to have you here, as I said.
Good thing we're not on television because I'm blushing.
I think I might be too. It's okay. John, first let me just ask you, for those that don't really understand the term economic hitman, can you just give us a little background on exactly what does an economic hitman do?
Well, I think, Tambourine, it's fair to say that economic hitmen have created the world's first truly global empire. And it's the first empire that's been created primarily without the military. And I guess it's fair to say we work in many different ways, but perhaps the most common is that we will identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. However, the money doesn't go to the country. It goes to our own corporations to build infrastructure projects in that country, like power plants and industrial parks, things that benefit a few wealthy families in that country, as well as our own corporations, who are the primary beneficiaries, but don't help the majority of the people. They can't afford electricity. They don't get jobs in industrial parks because industrial parks don't hire many people. But they are left holding a huge debt, the whole country is, a debt they can't pay off. So at some point we go back and say, since you can't pay your debts, sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies without any environmental limitations, or send troops in support of ours to Iraq, or allow us to build a military base on your soil. And in a few cases when we economic hitmen fail, and I talk in my books about how I failed with Jaime Roldós, the democratically elected president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos of Panama, when we fail, the jackals go in, and they either overthrow governments or assassinate the leaders. So both Roldós and Torrijos were assassinated because they did not give in to my bribes, basically. They were not corruptible. They had integrity. And in a few cases where the jackals fail, like with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, where both the economic hitmen and the jackals failed, then and only then does the military go in. And so in this way, we've created this very subtle and very secret empire. And most Americans aren't even aware that they're reaping the benefits from a true empire that reaches around the globe.
John, let me ask you, if I may, just because I have never heard until today the term jackal, I could probably you know, get an idea of what it is, but can you just give a definition of what a jackal is?
Well, these are people, usually men, a few women, who are trained to either go in and create turmoil in a country to overthrow a president, as they've done many times, for example, with Mossadegh in Iran back in the early 50s. They tried to do this with Hugo Chavez in 2002 in Venezuela. They successfully did it in Honduras in 2009. They know techniques for going in and stirring up people, paying a few people to organize demonstrations, thugs basically, to do this. Or jackals also will assassinate presidents, as they did with Roldos and Torrijos, and they've done with a number of others. They're usually trained by the CIA or the special forces, one of these type of units, sometimes in other countries. South Africa used to be a big training spot for them. But they usually, when they finally do this work today, they're employed by private consultants because the government doesn't want to have a direct connection, just as I was employed by a private consulting firm. My firm was employed by the U.S. government, but I specifically, my paycheck was written by a private consulting company, and that's true with most of the jackals today. The old agent, you know, the 007, the agent with a license to kill, is extinct, essentially, today. There's a few of them left, I think, in the CIA, but mostly that's farmed out to private consultants because it's so much safer.
Yeah, I would imagine. So basically, it's the old bait and switch, what you just described.
It is. It is. There's a big bribe on the one hand, and these presidents know this. They're very aware of this, that you go in and you offer huge bribes, and they're legal bribes in general, but they are bribes. And there's no question that these presidents know that if they subject their countries to these onerous loans, they themselves and their families are going to make millions of dollars. On the other hand, if they don't go along with the system, they know what happened to Lumumba in the Congo, and to Mossadegh, and to Diem in Vietnam, and to Allende in Chile, and Arbenz in Guatemala, and Roldos and Torrijos, and on and on and on. They're very aware of this. And, you know, you put yourself in the spot of one of these presidents, you're either offered a lot of money for you and your family, and also you're offered a real way of justifying to your people why you're taking these loans, which was the studies I did, or you figure you're going to be overthrown or assassinated. It takes a lot of courage to defy the combination of economic hitmen and the jackals. And sometimes I think it takes a certain amount of insanity, quite frankly. I think a guy like Chavez, who successfully did defy all of these people, he had to have a great deal of courage and perhaps a bit of insanity, too.
Well, you know, speaking of courage and maybe a little insanity, but tremendous inner strength and impeccability, I mean, I'm fascinated, frankly. I really would like to ask you about the profound moment in which someone that was living and breathing within the constructs of this reality chose to make a different choice. What was that like for you, and when did that happen?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm very heroic, and it happened, you know, I had a bolt of lightning and decided to take the right course, but it happened, it was a little more subtle than that. It happened over a long period of time. I was an economic hitman for 10 years. My official title, incidentally, was chief economist at Charles T. Maine, a big consulting firm in Boston. I had several dozen employees working for me. I had an official title that sounded very good, but my real job was a con man. And all the guys who worked for me produced reports that supported my con man work. And the first time, over the period of 10 years, I began more and more to see what I was doing that was wrong. At first, I tried to convince myself that it was right, what I was doing. And in fact, business schools teach that if you put a large amount of money into infrastructure in a country, like big power systems, you're going to help the economy. And statistically, you can show that the GDP, gross domestic product, does grow. But what the statistics don't show is that only a few very wealthy families really gain from that. The majority of the people in most of these countries live outside the statistical economy. They buy their goods and services and sell their produce in local markets that don't ever make the national statistics. Often it's done by barter. They are outside the economy, and they get poorer and poorer and poorer in the system. They lose their land, but to flooding by big hydroelectric projects and damage from oil companies and so forth. So over time, I saw what terrible damage we were actually doing while saying that we were doing the right thing and while trying to convince myself that we were doing the right thing. And then I did have a bit of an epiphany. After 10 years, I was sailing in the Caribbean. I was on vacation. And one evening, I climbed up to these old sugarcane plantation ruins up on top of a hill in St. John Island in the Virgin Islands. And as I sat there amidst this beautiful bougainvillea, these beautiful ruins, looking out over the sun setting on the Caribbean, I was feeling that there was a very idyllic sort of thing. And then suddenly, I was struck by the fact that this plantation had been built on the bones of thousands of slaves. And then I thought about how the whole hemisphere, including North America, has been built on the bones of millions of slaves and indigenous people and so forth. And then I had to admit that I, too, was a slaver, that the work I was doing, though subtle, I wasn't, you know, going into jungles and dragging people out in chains, but I was doing a more subtle type of slavery, but equally as bad. And I made the decision right then and there that I'd never do it again. I went back and quit. I tried, after that, I started to write the book that became Confessions of an Economic Hitman a couple of times, and each time I contacted other economic hitmen and jackals to try to get their stories to include, and each time I received anonymous threats. My daughter was born in 82, her life was threatened, and then I was offered a big bribe, a consulting firm, Stone & Webster, which still exists. I name names in these books.
That's amazing to me, you know?
Yeah, the chairman of the board of Stone & Webster took me out to dinner one night in New York, and he said, you know, you got a great resume, chief economist and so on and so forth. We want to use your resume in some of our proposals. You won't have to do any work. Just let us use your resume, and we'll pay you $500,000 consultant retainer, $500,000. Just don't write the book I know you're working on.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, Tambourine, I was not a hero. I knew, I'd seen what happened, and I had a young daughter. I was scared. I took the bribe, and I have to say I put a lot of the money toward nonprofit organizations that I'm very proud of. The result of those you can see on Pachamama.org or DreamChange.org. A couple of these nonprofits are very active today. So it assuaged my guilt a little bit, but I didn't write the book. And then on 9/11, I was in the Amazon, but when I came home, I was in the Amazon working with one of these nonprofits. When I came home, I went to Ground Zero, and as I stood there looking down at that still smoldering pit, I knew I had to write the book. And this time, though, I decided that I wouldn't tell anyone I was writing it. I wouldn't write a proposal. I had 5 books on shamanism and indigenous people published at that point. I was a published author. I knew the routine. You write a proposal, you get it in advance. I didn't do any of that. I wrote the whole book. My wife, my daughter, didn't know what I was writing about. I wrote the whole book, no proposal. When I had it all done, I gave it to my agent who sent it out to the big publishing houses. And at that point, it became my best insurance policy. Because the jackals know at that point, once it's out there, once all the information's out there, what they want to do is keep you out of the public image. And it's, even today, if somebody shoots me this evening, you know, my publishers will get very wealthy off of it because it'll sell a lot more books. It's, you know, Confessions have sold millions of copies, but it'll sell a lot more, and people who would never otherwise have read it will suddenly go out and buy it if something strange happens to me and it makes the papers. So the book became my insurance policy. In fact, once it was finished and I get the word out there, that the publishers already had it.
Yeah, that's a very powerful place to be at, you know, just standing firm in speaking your truth. And, well, I'll just ask, do you ever have moments of fear even now?
I've had threats. And a couple of companies, Bechtel Corporation, a missionary group that I talk about in the books, and several others wrote me letters that were setting me up for big lawsuits and demanding that we change titles or we take their names out of the book or we change chapters or we omit chapters and so on and so forth. In each case, my publisher, Barrett Kohler, out of San Francisco, who was the original publisher, who stood behind me very, very beautifully, and we sent them my backup files, and I have incredible backup files, And once they saw the backup files, they went away. And in fact, we told them, you know, if you pursue this attempt to blackmail me, basically, we're going to write an addendum to the next edition of the book talking about what you've done to try to squelch the information. So they went away. And, you know, I know jackals well enough to know that they're not likely to come after me at this point because they know that'll defeat their own purposes. It'll get the word out much more. The U.S. State Department put out a special website saying that this was misinformation, and it sold lots of my books. It helped the sales of the books. So they learn lessons this way. And I guess the other side of it is I'm 65. I've got a 2.5-year-old grandson. What have I got to fear except not trying to change the world, not trying to make a better world for my grandson? I mean, that's got to be, you know, my primary objective at this point in my life. And to be honest with you, I'm having a lot of fun doing it. I feel very honored that, like, I'm speaking at the Seattle Green Festival this coming weekend, June 5th, and then I'm speaking in Vancouver at the Prophets Conference. And I get to speak to large groups of people and wonderful people. I speak a lot at universities, at MBA programs, even increasingly at conferences for business executives. So I'm in a position suddenly where I can start to really try to make an impact on people. And I feel blessed to be in that position, and I there's nothing more rewarding to me at this point in my life than to try to create a better world for my grandson. And I know, Tambourine, that the only way my grandson is going to inherit a better world is if every child born in Ethiopia and Botswana and Bolivia and Indonesia and Palestine and Israel also has a better world. We live on a very tiny planet. For the first time in human history, we're so integrated and interrelated that we've got to understand that the only way we can have homeland security is when we recognize that the whole world is our homeland.
You know, John, listening to you, I can't help but be reminded that within the choices that you've made to use your experiences in making it a better world and making those changes, bringing things that have been done in the dark into the light, there is a compassion there. You know, you talking about us being a one world and one people and all of that, the root of that is love and compassion. And with love and compassion, there is no greater light than that. So those who do their business in the dark, they really have no point of strength, because it's like there is no source of darkness. Like, you can't shoot a ray of darkness, but if there's a dark room, you want, like, one little candle or one little match. It doesn't force the darkness into some other place. It literally transmutes the darkness into light, and it's just so far-reaching what you're doing and the message. It just broadcasts a frequency of love. I translate it into compassion, and that is the most powerful thing in existence. And I know that anything that you endeavor to do with that message and with that intention absolutely is going to be like a juggernaut, unstoppable. I fully, full-heartedly believe that.
I agree. You know, I think that once we make a commitment to doing the right thing, the universe kind of conspires to help us, and that works that way. I totally agree with you. And you know, it was interesting. A few years ago, I had the good fortune of spending some time with the Dalai Lama in Ladakh, northern India, and in his home in Dharamsala. And I was leading a group of about 30 people on a trip there, like the ones I do now to Guatemala for the Prophets Conference. And when the Dalai Lama first came into the group to greet my group, he said, he welcomed us, and then he said, you know, I just want to say, don't become a Buddhist. The world doesn't need more Buddhists. But do follow the Buddhist principles of compassion. And I thought that was very beautiful, you know. I mean, he's saying, you know, you don't have to follow the hierarchy. You don't have to wear the saffron robes or anything like that. But just recognize compassion. And I think that is we've got to move in that direction. And my life today, Tamarine, is devoted to trying to create change. And I realize that we've got to wrap love around these things. I mean, and compassion. We've got to wrap love and compassion around this horrible oil spill that's, you know, inundating the Gulf now and threatening to perhaps even reach around the entire planet. Who knows? But we can't put up with that anymore. But we also, I think we really have to deal with it from the standpoint of compassion that we have for the animals and the plants and the people and so on that are involved in this, and really look at it much more from that standpoint than from the standpoint of anger at criminals. I mean, those men are criminals that allowed this to happen, there's no question. But let's move into a sphere where we really look at how we're going to change the world from a perspective of compassion rather than one of revenge. And I just have to say, every time I see one of these BP guys on television or hear them on the radio, the chairman of the board or someone like that, I feel terribly sorry for these people. I can't imagine having their lack of conscience, or I can't imagine being in their shoes. You know, I was in some pretty bad shoes myself, so I guess I can sympathize in a way. I'm not in any way excusing them. They're criminals. They should be brought to justice. But the main thing is, we must make sure this never happens again, and we must do that from a paradigm of compassion and a love, I think, to make sure that we approach this whole issue of how we can take care of our planet as an issue of love and compassion for the planet and all sentient beings upon it.
You know, I mean, I absolutely resonate totally with what you're saying. I think you're a perfect example of that because, you know, whatever shoes that you were in, you know, you could call it a criminal, you could call it a economic hitman, someone with no conscience, but I mean, you know, the people who are listening to you in this moment, you're not that man. You are a different version of that man that is absolutely vibrating on a different whole radio station. I mean, you are not playing the music that you did when you were that other man. So these people, BP and other executives that are having that human experience, playing that character in this stage play that we're all in, you hit the nail on the head in regard to the key of this whole game we're playing here. And it's, if you can look at even characters as that, the Bushes, the Cheneys, the villains in this movie with compassion and be able to look past or overlook the seductive yearning to want to just nail their asses, you know, and just really blame and get into everything that one would say that they are worthy of. If one could look past that and just focus on the compassion and love for what we need to do to shift into this higher version of Earth and humanity, that is our what is it called? The Monopoly? Don't go to jail, pass go, collect $200.
Right. Yeah. And I think, Tamarine, we have to recognize that we all have a responsibility here. And again, I'm not in any way condoning the criminal activities that went on, even if they, legally speaking, were not criminal, and we're not sure whether they were or weren't, but morally, ethically, they certainly were. But I think we all have to also understand that we've been sending a message to our corporations. And that message is, I want cheap T-shirts and tennis shoes, even if they happen to be made by slaves in sweatshops in Indonesia or Honduras. I'll just look the other way. I won't pay any attention to that. I just want them cheap. And we want cheap petroleum for our cars. We don't want to pay more for our gas at the pump. And if that means destroying the Amazonian rainforest or the Gulf of Mexico, I'll just kind of look the other way. And so we've been sending this very, very strong message to these corporations. And we have to recognize that we all have to take responsibility for that. And we have to send a different message. These corporations basically follow a premise of what I call predatory capitalism, which really grew out of the Milton Friedman Chicago School of Economics theories that came up in the 70s when I was an economic hitman, and then were embraced by Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, other world leaders, in 1980 and have been embraced by every U.S. president, Democrat and Republican alike since. And the main premise of that predatory form of capitalism is the only responsibility of business is to make profits, to maximize profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. And in a way, we consumers have embraced that. We said, well, go ahead and make your profits and give us the cheapest goods you can. And if that means hurting laborers in other countries or hurting environments in other countries, we don't care. Now it's time we turn that around and we said, you know, it's okay for business to make some profits, but you can only do it when we're only going to buy from businesses that are committed to a sustainable, just and peaceful world. And, you know, I mean, I'm very struck, like at the Green Festivals, like the one in Seattle this coming weekend, there'll be a huge marketplace full of vendors who've been vetted for being green, for being socially and environmentally responsible. They're not all perfect. In fact, probably none of them are 100% perfect. Who amongst us is? But they're all trying. They're working toward creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful economy in the world. And those are the people we need to buy from. We need to let them know that we appreciate what they're doing. On the other hand, we need to send emails to Nike and other companies and say, we're not buying anymore from you because you've got sweatshops, or it doesn't matter whether it's BP or Exxon or Shell or whoever, we're not buying from you because you're destroying the Amazon and the Gulf of Mexico. Straighten out. We've got to get off oil.
Yeah, that's absolutely right on the money. I mean, personal responsibility, again, the everyday person has so much power that they don't even realize that they have in regard to making choices like that. You know, what came to mind when I was listening to you, where has the misconception been that there's no money to be made in new technologies, technologies that are eco-friendly? I mean, my God.
Yeah. That's, you know, in my most recent book, Hoodwinked, that book is all about what we've got to do to turn this around. And there's five very large general areas I talk about that every one of us can participate in, any one of those or in all of them, and then specifics within that. But one of those areas is about changing our whole economy. And, you know, I was recently in Nicaragua, and I was there with a group of philanthropic investors, people who'd made a lot of money in this country, and most of them in new high-tech jobs, and sold their companies, and now wanted to help campesinos. And they're interested in investing money philanthropically without necessarily getting any return, to help campesinos in Nicaragua grow organic produce. And Whole Foods had expressed a very strong interest in buying this produce, and so had a number of other companies. But as we traveled around Nicaragua, and I speak Spanish fluently, as we traveled around Nicaragua, we discovered that much of the land there has been destroyed by Dole and Chiquita and Kraft and Cargill. It's full of insecticides and other chemicals that cannot be farmed organically. And Nicaragua has two huge lakes you can't see across them. It's endowed with wonderful water resources, terribly polluted to a large degree by our industries. And I was struck by how, what if, We the taxpayer, demanded that our government take a percentage of its current military budget, pay the same companies it's currently paying to make missiles and tanks, you know, the Raytheons and the General Electrics and General Dynamics and so forth, pay them to instead come up with technologies and machines that will clean up the polluted lands of Nicaragua and the rest of the world, because the whole world's polluted, and the polluted water and the polluted air. And we also encourage entrepreneurs to come up with these technologies, you know, and what if we took another percentage of our military budget and encouraged companies like Kraft and Cargill, you know, some of those companies have brilliant people working for them who are not sociopaths, the scientists, the normal people that work in there, who'd be much happier if we paid them to create new ways for people in Africa to grow food and store it at a local level and distribute it at local levels for starving people to feed themselves. You know, we can create a whole new economy. Sustainable energy is one thing that everybody's talking about, and that's a good one. But there's so many other things that we can do. We've polluted this planet. We can clean it up. We can clean it, and we can feed starving people. We roughly half the people on this planet are living in dire poverty. We can change that. We need to create a new economy it's based on that. And in fact, that's what a lot of the people who are selling things at the marketplace at Green Festival are doing. And there are many people doing this today. We really need to encourage that. I'm so fired up by this. And when I speak at MBA programs at universities, which I do a lot of these days, and these kids are, you know, they've got their MBAs now and there's no jobs up there. I say, well, go create a company that does really good things and you will be successful if you do that. It will happen. I know it will happen.
I love your passion, John. I mean, it is absolutely a motor, an engine that is driving this new era, and I'm really glad that a mind such as yours is driven by that passion because it inevitably invokes change. On that note, I'm going to take a break now. We're speaking with John Perkins, the author of the once New York Times bestseller, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, his recent book, Hoodwinked, and he's going to be this weekend at the Green Festival in Seattle, which is just about an hour away from me. I think you may see me, John. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back with John Perkins. We're here with John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman and of his latest book, Hoodwinked. I'm going to remind everyone again that he will be in Seattle this weekend, actually this coming weekend, June 5th, at the Green Festival. And John, is there a place where maybe your website, they can go get some more details of your calendar and all that?
Yeah, that would be great. JohnPerkins.org. The calendar's there, and I'd encourage people to subscribe to my newsletter, which comes out about once a month. We don't overwhelm people with stuff, but once a month, subscribe to that. My calendar's on there. And also, I'm on Twitter at economic_hitman. Love to chat more with people. And yeah, they can also go to the Green Festival website and get a lot more information about all the speakers. It's a pretty amazing event, and the marketplace is phenomenal.
Yes, as we were just speaking off the air, John is also going to be at the Profits Conference in Vancouver. That's going to be at the end of July. Two very different type of venues, although, as we have been speaking about this whole show, it is absolutely bringing both trains of thought together. You know, the humanness of the things that we experience day to day and what our economic and social climate is, and then bridging that with the spiritual, the esoteric. They're both valid and both very profound and powerful subjects.
They are indeed, and that's, in my view, they're very, very connected. Sometimes people don't make that connection, but in my view, this is extremely connected. This whole environmental, this whole green movement, and when I say that, I don't just mean environmental, it has to include social also. I think it has to be looked at as spiritual too, and people sometimes have problems with the word spiritual because they think it refers to one particular type of religion or whatever, but to me it's going deep into what spirit is all about, and spirit is what inspires us to create better worlds for ourselves and our children and grandchildren. And so it's a spiritual movement that's also very green.
Yeah, I mostly laugh when I think about this because, being someone that has lived as almost every known religion that there is, being born a Catholic, being a Muslim for a period of time, a born-again Christian, a witch studying Wicca, and then being an initiate at an ancient wisdom mystery school. I've pretty much tasted every gamut of my pursuit and journey of spiritual endeavor. So, I've learned that spirituality, there's nothing more spiritual than just being real and just being yourself. You don't have to, like what you said about the Dalai Lama, it just was perfect because, you don't have to, and this is just my experience, you don't have to say a certain thing, wear a certain thing, do certain chants or affirmations to be who you naturally are. And the greater part of all of us is the most spiritual thing you can be in whatever that is. I just have found that the more that I am real and just who I am, and that person may cuss sometimes, that person may say off-the-cuff things, but, just being true to who you are is absolutely spiritual. So that was just a little side note from the Peanut Gallery.
Well, I also think, Tamboraine, you're mentioning how you've been involved in all these different religions is very insightful because it wasn't long ago that people were brought up with one very narrow view of religion. In fact, when I was a kid growing up in rural New Hampshire, there were basically two forms of religion in my area. One was Protestantism and one was Catholicism. And they were still at war with each other. I grew up as a Calvinist, the Protestant side, and Calvinist, a Puritan. And my parents used to tell me, it's okay to go to school and talk to the Catholic boys and girls, but don't ever get serious about a Catholic girl. You couldn't possibly marry one, And of course, now I'm the partner who's speaking with me. We do workshops together in Vancouver at the Prophets Conference, for example, and lead trips together to Guatemala. She was a French Canadian girl in the same community, Lynn Roberts, and today, kids, my grandson is 2.5. I mean, some of the books he's already starting to read, have elements of Buddhism and Hinduism in them, and Muslim, Islam, and Christian. I mean, it's now people are exposed around the world to a great many religions, and there's still, of course, this terrible conflict, and we see that in the Middle East in a big way. But it's usually just as in times past too, uses religion as an excuse. But the fact of the matter is, today we're really, most of us are exposed to many, many different forms of spirituality, and I think that's very positive, that the blinders have been taken off, and I think they continue to come off, and as we meld all of these together, as you have done in your personal life, we, I think, ultimately come to the conclusion, as you have, that spirituality is not about any of those religions. As the Dalai Lama said, it's about being compassionate, it's about being true to yourself, as you pointed out.
John, I am so interested to ask you about the subject matters of one of your books in regard to shamanism and how that relates to your perspective of shifting into consciousness into this new era that we're all going into.
You're probably referring to shape-shifting, which is about shape-shifting, about shifting things. And in another book, The World is As You Dream It. And I think that, you know, I first worked with shamans in 1968. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Amazon and then in the Andes, where I spent 3 years there. And I still go back often. I have three godchildren with indigenous people in that area. And I've worked a lot with the shamans. I've been initiated into their forms of shamanism, et cetera. And I think one of the most important things they always taught me is that the world is as we dream it, as we perceive it, as we want to create it. And that's why it's so important for us to give energy to the idea of compassion and love, even as we're dealing with things like this terrible oil spill. Because we want to dream a world of compassion and love. We do get the world that we dream. And after I stopped being an economic hitman, and I went back to the Amazon, and I said to these people, you know, I want to help you now save your rainforest. This is the Shwa people that I was with. If you've ever seen a shrunken head or a picture of one, they did it. They're the only people who do that. These were very, what we'd call wild, what we'd call primitive people living in the jungle. Hitchering, incidentally, is very spiritual. It's not what most of us think of it as gory. It's a putting to rest of the spirit, but that's another story. And I went back down to them, and I said, I want to help you save your forest. And they said, well, listen, that's wonderful, but if you want to help us save our forest, don't come here. We're not destroying the forest. Don't try to change us. It's your people who are destroying the forest. It's your oil companies. And they are. They're doing, you know, the Chevron has done in the Ecuadorian Amazon much worse than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It's about equivalent to what's happened, I think, in the Gulf at this point, though we don't really know what's happened in the Gulf at this point. I'm sure the Gulf is ultimately going to be much worse. But Chevron did it intentionally. It was Texaco, and Chevron bought Texaco. They did it intentionally. It was not an accident. And it's terrible. But these people said, so, you know, don't come and try to change us. You've got to change your dream. The world is as you dream it. And you people in the north have had a dream of lots of cars and big buildings and heavy industry, and you've given energy to that dream, so it's come true. Now you've got to turn it around because you're beginning to understand that it's destroying the planet as we know the planet. And so you've got to turn it around. So you've got to change your dream. That's all you've got to do is change the dream to a more compassionate dream, not such a materialistic dream. I came back after that and formed this nonprofit called Dream Change. And again, you can go to dreamchange.org and find out more. And out of that grew another nonprofit, Pachamama Alliance, which you can go to Pachamama.org to find out more about that, and many other things have come out of these about changing the dream, which is where we need to go. And it's taught me to have great hope that we can turn all of this around. It can happen fairly quickly if we can just change that dream, and that's one of the reasons I focus on this idea of changing the goal of the companies that we support, that we buy anything from. Buy only from companies that do not have the goal of maximizing profits regardless of social and environmental costs. Buy only from companies that have the goal of they can make profits, but within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world, being environmentally and socially responsible. And send them emails. Send the Nikes emails saying you're not going to buy from them until they become environmentally and socially responsible, and send the emails to the ones that you'll see at the Green Festival, for example, that are that way, and tell them you really appreciate what they're doing and you'll continue to buy from them. It means a lot. Those companies do see those emails. They make matrices. They go up to the CEO that tell him what, he doesn't read each email, but he sees a matrix of what the emails are saying.
Well, coming from the background that you have, that insight definitely holds weight, because I think, you know, some everyday people, they're like, well, I don't know, would it even make a difference if I sent an email, just little old me?
It absolutely makes a huge difference. And on my website, on the home page, there's if you go about halfway down, you'll see a thing that says great links for petitions, and you can press on that and you can go to dozens of petitions that you can sign. You know, you can pick and choose depending on what any listener is moved by. We got to follow our own passions, and so there's petitions there that you can sign, obviously against BP, and also Chevron. There's a huge lawsuit against Chevron in the Amazon right now that Chevron is fighting tooth and nail. Sign a petition there, or there's petitions you can sign about protecting animals more, an endangered species, or lost children, or slave children. There's all kinds of petitions that can be signed and are being delivered. So I'd really encourage people to do that. These things do have, they carry tremendous weight. The people running our corporations are human beings. Some of them are sociopaths and don't give a damn, but most of them are not. And even beneath the top of the guy like Phil Knight at Nike is probably a sociopath, but the people working directly under him are not, and they do pay attention to these things. And besides that, they know that if we stop buying their products, they'll go out of business. A lot of big U.S. corporations have gone out of business, and we've had a huge impact. We get corporations to clean up rivers that were on fire in Ohio, and when I went to Boston University back in the late 60s, you couldn't walk beside the Charles River. It was so polluted. We got it cleaned up. We got rid of apartheid in South Africa by boycotting corporations. Recently, we've gotten trans fats out of foods and antibiotics out of chickens by demonstrating, by not buying, by boycotting. We have tremendous power. Now we need to ratchet it up a notch and say, it's not just about those specific issues. Let's move to a higher level and say, we're not going to buy from any company that isn't socially and environmentally responsible and totally committed to being socially and environmentally responsible.
Now, do you see that's what we're going, based on catastrophes like this Gulf oil situation, do you see a silver lining based on what's happening there?
Yeah, it's hard to see a silver lining in something that's so tragic, isn't it? But I do, in a way. I hope it's a wake-up call, along with the exploding volcanoes and the shrinking glaciers and the terrible oil disasters in the Amazon and elsewhere. I hope it's a wake-up call. You know, I think as we look at these pictures of this oil spreading across the Gulf of Mexico, we ought to see that as symbolic of pollution and corruption spreading across our whole planet, and drive us to changing that. Just before, you know, we went on the air here, I was listening to another race. I was listening to an NPR news bulletin, and basically BP is saying that they haven't stopped it yet. No matter what they've done, they haven't. There's a possibility that they'll never stop this oil spill. There's a possibility that this oil spill could destroy all the oceans. There's that possibility. We all hope it's not going to happen, but we need to recognize that we're at a point in history where one oil well drilled so deep with so much pressure behind it could conceivably destroy our oceans. And if that happens, it'll destroy our planet as we know it. This could conceivably happen, and we must make sure that we're never going to accept that possibility again, whether it's oil drilling in the Gulf, or oil drilling in the Amazon for that matter, or mining for coal, or anything else. We've got to make sure that we're more responsible.
You know, in regard to that, and kind of segueing into this Prophets Conference in Vancouver, July 23rd through the 27th, its title is 2012 Tipping Point. Now, how do you see this timeline that we're on now going into 2012? I really would love to hear your perspective on that, what you'll be speaking about at that right. prophet's conference.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with the Maya people of Central America beginning back in the 70s, and I just led a trip down there for the Prophets Conference with Lynn Roberts in last December, and we'll be doing another one this coming December. And we spent a lot of time doing ceremonies with the shamans and talking with them, with the Mayan elders and wise people. And they all see this period that we're entering as one with the potential for tremendous transformation, moving out of a period of darkness, moving out of a period of greed and exploitation of resources, natural and human, into a period of compassion. They see this as a possibility. That's what the prophecy is really about. It's not about the dire things that the movie showed. I mean, that could happen if we don't take the right route. Who knows? But the idea is that they hold out this possibility that we're at this time in history with this tremendous potential for us to move to a new level of consciousness as human beings, into an understanding of our relationship with each other and our planet. And you know, I think this ties in so well, Tambourine, with what's really happening now, because for the first time in history, every human being on this planet, every life form is impacted by the same crises. It used to be you had hurricanes in Florida and earthquakes in San Francisco and tsunamis in Indonesia, and they didn't really impact each other that much. But today we're all impacted by global climate change. We're all impacted by resources that are diminishing at accelerating rates, and prices of fuel and food that are and other essentials that are increasing at accelerating rates, by overpopulation and species extinction, violence due to starvation and deprivation around the world. Every human being, every life form is impacted by these things for the first time in history. And we're truly one on the small planet. And for the first time in history, we're all communicating with each other through cell phones and the internet. Everybody's talking to everybody around the world. This puts us in this amazing position to understand that we must change. We must adopt a new principle by which to run our lives. And that goes along very much with the Mayan prophecy of 2012 and many other prophecies. The Quechua have the prophecy of the eagle and the condor. The Tibetans, the Buddhists have the prophecy that the 14th Dalai Lama will be the last. And this one is the 14th. And he tells me that he thinks he may be the last Buddhist Dalai Lama, that the next Dalai Lama may come out of the Amazon or the Andes and not know a darn thing about formal Buddhism, but will know about compassion. We'll know about the principles of Buddhism without necessarily knowing about all the practices of Buddhism, which he can learn if he has to. But so we're in this time that every indigenous culture I've worked with, and I've worked with indigenous cultures in northern Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, in all of the Americas, and every one of them has a prophecy that this is the time for potential for transformation. But we have to do it. It's not going to happen automatically. We have to do it.
Just said it right there. That prophecy, there's as many different versions of what can happen as there are people. And the point is, what do you as an individual, and I speak generally now to everyone, what do you want to experience? What radio station do you want to dial into? One of compassion and love and a new version of this planet, of ourselves individually and totally as a human family, or the version that you saw in the movie? I think that the version John speaks of and the one that is in my heart to experience definitely is one of beauty, one of love, and of compassion. And on that note, we are out of time. I want to thank John from the bottom of my heart being a part of this show. And I want to again remind everyone, he is going to be at the Green Festival in Seattle this coming weekend. And actually, we're going to repeat this show next Saturday at the same time. I will be in Colorado giving a workshop, so you'll get the opportunity to hear this brilliant man again. And once, let's see, what time are you speaking? What day and time for the Prophets Conference? Do you know what you're
saying? Oh, the Prophets Conference, I'm not sure. That's July 23rd is when it starts in Vancouver.
And yes, July 23rd through the 27th.
Right, and I'm not sure exactly which day. I think I'm doing a couple of things, a speech and then a workshop with Lynn Roberts. So people they can go to the Prophets Conference website and get the details. So
beautiful. And I want to remind everyone that we are giving away 2 passes every show to the conference. If you are interested in going, you can email evolution@tamborineborelli.com. That's TamborineBorelli. And you can come and see John Perkins in person. John, again, thank you so much. John's new book coming out, Hoodwinked, you can get it on Amazon. And if you want to stay in contact with him, the email address is, John?
JohnPerkins.org, and Twitter, you can tweet me at economic_hitman.
John, again, it's been my honor. Thank you so much, and I do look forward to meeting up with you in Vancouver.
Likewise, Tamborine, and you're welcome, and thank you so much for spreading the word and the good news and the compassion and the love. That's what it's going to take. Thank you so much.
My honor. Thank you. We'll see you next week, everyone. Have a beautiful week.